If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to The Stack. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
And on The Stack, we talk about a bunch of books that came out this week. And we got some biggies. Let's kick it off with the biggest, beefiest
one of all. And some smallies.
And some smallies and some meatimies, as we like to call it. We say this every week, right?
This is how we do the intro. Yeah. We dip into our Italian newsboy characters.
Yeah.
Oh, some smallies. Hey, let's go play some stickball.
What's a black and white and covered with a spicy spaghetti sauce? That's my Italian news. Was that
That's pretty good and not offensive. Not
quite. Oh, good. Okay. That's what I wanted to check. I was worried it was offensive, but it's not.
You've crossed the line yet again, right in the first 30 to 40 seconds of our podcast.
Perfect. You know who never crosses a line is Batman. In Absolute Batman number 19 from DC Comics, written by Scott Snyder, art by Nick Dragotta. We're kicking off a new arc here. And there's some big stuff going down, so I'm going to put a spoiler warning, not just for this book, but every book we talk about in The Stack. And I should also mention, if you want this podcast and all the podcasts we do ad-free, patreon.com/comicbookclub. Come hang out. We have a very active Discord where delightfully, positively argue about all this stuff all day long. It's very nice. I've really been enjoying it lately.
And positively. They're friends. Yes. It's a friendly chat.
It is a friendly chat, just like this is about this book, because Batman is going through some changes. He has decided to be Batman full-time. Alfred Pennyworth isn't quite so sure about it, but maybe it is the right time to be Batman full-time, because the Absolute Scarecrow has arrived. The Joker is making big moves in Gotham, and by the end of the issue, not only is one major character dead that absolutely should not be dead, but Deathstroke has arrived, we've been introduced to the Robins, and things are about to go wild as usual. Justin, what'd you think about this one?
I mean, what a great time to double down in your career when all your friends are turned into hideous freaks. You know, that's what I'm waiting for, to really dedicate myself to podcasting, as I'm waiting for some crazy crocodiling of you and Pete to turn into some sort of three-face.
Well, he's not here, so we don't know what's going on with him physically at this point.
Yeah, he could be triple-faced.
Or maybe he's like doing great.
What if he's like two-faced but for like a 20-sided die? So he has to roll a 20-sided die anytime that he makes a choice.
Yeah. There was that character that was introduced in Christian Ward's Two-Face series that rolled a die. It wasn't a 20-sided die, though.
It was regular, classic six-side.
Yes. I wanted to make a Dungeons and Dragons joke, but I couldn't come up with anything. I thought this issue was pretty great. Wild stuff going down. Nothing feels bigger in comics right now than this. This really is blockbuster comic storytelling. I know that there's like a lot of discussion about the story in particular on our Discord, but I've been enjoying it.
Yes, me too. And I want to say, like, this is, Scott, I hope you're listening, because this is a great quote to put on a trade. Like, a lot of people say they go balls to the wall, but they take their balls off the wall.
Right.
This book has this, its balls on the wall. It lives, its balls live on the wall. It's crazy how
its
much
balls
is
crawling all the way up the wall, going up to the ceiling, and then coming back down to the other wall.
Yeah. These balls are moving, and you can see them, and they're sometimes beefy balls. The way this issue plays out is, I'm like, oh, very cool. There, we meet the Scarecrow, Absolute Scarecrow, very cool, scary, different. And then we're getting back into battle, like, oh, what an interesting change for him. Oh, he's sort of a dick to his friends who are super fucked up. And then the surprise happens, and I was like, whoa. What? And then it's not even the end of the issue. You get the Robin stuff. You get Deathstroke. I was like, this is. And I'm what Scott has done here with this, just story-wise, it makes me love and dread what's happening. Because mm-hmm. when I see the names of those Robins written in here, I'm like, I like all of them. I'm sad for all of them here. And so he's got me just hooked so hard.
I will say that there is a level that I wish we were just getting Scarecrow in this issue, in this arc. I mean, we'll see how it pans out. We're right at the beginning here. But I thought one of the things that was so good about the Bane arc was that it was hyper-focused on Bane while all of these other things, horrible things, were happening around the side. But everything was focused on that. The introduction to Scarecrow is great. He's like a Hitchcock nightmare mixed with something out of a Blumhouse movie, and that's the perfect place for this thing to live in. I love that, and I love the fact that he is riffing off of current fears and current divisions in society that's so relatively timely. It's looking at the world outside. All that stuff is great. And then you have all of these other elements that are going on in the ongoing soap opera that I love as well. But again, there's a level that I wish like we were just focusing on that first thing, but this is the beginning of the arc. I'm curious to see how it plays out.
I'm sure we'll get there. But what I liked about this is that it reminded me of like classic like hero villain comics, where it was like, what's the hero up to? The villain, he's weird, who cares? Like, it's just no backstory necessary. With Bane, it was all backstory, like why is he important? Comics and all of our stories in sort of modern society are like, the villain has to be so cool, so interesting, tragic story. And honestly, to have just a straight up terrifying villain here, I was like, good. That's good. There's so much going on with everyone else. And also the narration of Alfred here is a whole nother side of the story. Like, we're getting his slanted POV on Bruce, and it's cool. It's nice. It also adds judgment and darkness to this already dark tale.
How do you feel about the big death in the issue? Because threw me for a loop.
Same, but in a good way. Like, I mean, we're going to say it here in 3, 2, 1. Jim Gordon dies, like, very upsettingly.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely tragic. It comes out of nowhere. And what they do here, both Nick's art and Scott's story, is they set something that we have seen 100 times. Batman and Jim talking on a roof that we're like, oh, a regular thing. In this crazy absolute world where it's everything's extreme, here's a regular thing. Nope, gotcha again. It's very extreme in a deeply unsettling way. And it's unsettling twice, because it's unsettling when it happens, and then it's unsettling when Batman saves him, but not really.
Mm-hmm.
Which was, thought it was great.
I think
great.
That's pointing to something that is really working about the Absolute Universe, is it's not about walking us up to the place we know. Like, what I felt reading that scene and everything that they've been doing with Gordon over the past couple of issues is, oh, we're getting to the classic dynamic. Here we go. And like you said, we're on a rooftop and he's got a clue and it's a different bat signal, but he's been summoned by a bat signal. And once again, they're like, no, that's not what we're doing here. We're not doing that. Batman cannot save everybody because he cannot be Batman full time. He needs to figure out something else for himself. This is a different world with different story beats and different story arcs. When a lot of these types of stories we've seen in the past are all origin stories to get us to the place we know. That's not this.
Well, and it's like, but it's still smartly using the same seed or root. It's just the tree on each of these is twisted in either direction, too, because like with the villains start as heroes, as or at least Bruce's friends on the side of the hero. But we see this Killer Croc scene in this where Batman is an asshole to him.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, you just created a villain right there. And it's all the more damaging that Batman knows and loves all of his villains, and he just can't deal with the situation that has been put on him.
Why don't we move to another alternate universe with Ultimate Wolverine, number 16 from Marvel, written by Chris Condon, art by Alessandro Capuccio. This is the final issue of this series as Wolverine and Jean Grey literally go to hell to try to kill Ileana Rasputin. Are they successful? We find out by the end of the issue as it leads into the events of Ultimate Endgame. Justin, how do you feel about this? And maybe unfair, but in comparison to what they're doing over the Absolute Universe.
Well, it is an unfair comparison because this is ending. Yeah. Sort of a sharp, very like slice the champagne, the cork off the champagne bottle end of the Ultimate Universe. When, like, I've enjoyed this book. I think this book really came alive at the end of the initial arc. We got this additional arc that was interesting and sort of I was like, oh, I want this dynamic. I love an Ultimate Logan and a Jean Grey out here. It reminded me of a better version of their relationship in the Age of Apocalypse. I was hoping we could see their relationship be a thing. But unfortunately, the Ultimate Universe is ending, and it feels like a hard chop here in two ways. This story does feel like it was an epilogue in a way, and a second adventure that was added on. And it's not that it's bad, but it just doesn't feel like a decisive conclusion. And then you have that added tack on thing of like, hey, we got to go kill the Maker, someone I know, that Wolverine says. And I was like, I don't know. I know that was like an editorial thing, but I was like, I don't know if I needed that right there.
Yeah, it's a real bummer because, like you said, I really like this team, and I think they did a lot of really interesting things on this book. I would have loved to see where they go long term. But, man, the Ultimate Universe, reading this book, my main takeaway, which is unfair to do this book, but it feels like they're really stumbling to the end here across the board, that, like, all of this stuff feels like, eh, we're going to wrap this up because we're done. Maybe I made this comparison before, but the Ultimate Universe feels like it's this balloon that got, like, blown up and blown up and blown up and blown up. And then Marvel, about 3 months ago, is like, we let go of the balloon. And the balloon's like, and just fizzing away into the distance as it gets smaller and smaller and smaller.
It is. It's very strange. And, like, it's especially strange because we talked about this a lot. Like, it was so meticulously constructed. It was constructed month by month in a real-time scenario. So that feels like it's deliberate. It feels like it was very decided what was going to happen. And the end feels so slapdash and so like, I don't know, they all show up. And I was like, don't wave your hand here. I believed in this story so hard. And it felt like you were building towards something. And your great work up top is making this sort of middling work feel bad. And I'm not saying that about this book, because this book has been sort of nicely much on the fringes of the main story. I've actually liked all of that. They've been able to occupy the mutant side of this universe in a great way, while Ultimate X-Men is sort of doing its own very remote thing. This felt like it was just telling a good Wolverine story. And it's just that when it folds, the end of this folds back into the main title, I'm like, do they have something in the tank to end this with? Because Endgame has been, I haven't been enjoying it.
Yeah. To end on Endgame on a little positive note here, I will say that Alessandro Capuccio draws a really good Ileana. And I also thought Pyotr Rasputin, a.k.a. Colossus, was really good in this issue as well. There's a little bit of a flashback dream sequence type thing going on here. So in terms of that, I thought that was good. And there's some really sweet, sad character stuff that goes on. But yeah, as a whole, I don't know. It's just the end of the universe is affecting this.
So. Yeah.
Invincible Universe, Battle Beast number 8 from Skybound and Image Comics, written by Robert Kirkman, art by Ryan Ottley. In this issue, Battle Beast has a magic sword and is trying to kill two enormous dudes. Period.
Period. End of story. I gotta say, I enjoyed reading this issue, and I think I'm enjoying it especially because the Invincible animated show is airing.
Yes.
Like, it's such a pleasure to watch that and then be like, oh, my friends are here, and they're fighting in a different way. And I don't usually have that feeling, so I was very charmed by it.
Well, particularly because most of these characters are on the screen in the show right now. Yeah. Like, spoiler for this, but like, this is a flashback, so we're seeing some of the Viltrumites who died, like Conquest, and Craig didn't die, but Craig is there, yeah. General Craig. And yeah, Battle Beast doing his Battle Beast stuff. I did miss the supporting cast a little bit. This issue, yeah. We get our prince, who regrew his penis last issue. He's much less funny this issue, which is a bit of a bummer. And I don't think we see the robot lady who got a name last issue. No. I really should find out these characters' names. But yeah, it's charming. It's light. Robert Kirkman knows how to write this stuff in his sleep at this point. And Ryan Ottley is just drawing some disgusting battle scenes. Really, I do have a question for you, though. And this is a recurring question I have about the Invincible Universe. What's the deal with everybody eating each other?
I don't know. Everyone, this issue is about Battle Beast being like, can I have one more nibble on this corpse?
Well, it opens with Conquest being like, I love eating my enemies. This is so good. I killed all these guys and now I'm going to eat them. And then, yeah, like you're saying, most of this issue, Battle Beast is like, well, I chopped off the front of his head and now I'm going to, I'm licking all
really
over the inside.
Lick out the skull. Like, yeah. Finishing off a bowl of soup.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. It feels like maybe Kirkman has this idea of like these characters, Viltrumites, Battle Beasts, and these like pure warrior characters are like hunter prey. And it's really just that. So the eating is the satisfaction of the kill. But there's been so much built, especially around these characters, that like, nah, I just kill because I don't care about people.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe it's like Robert Kirkman heard once, I drink the blood of my enemies, and took that literally instead of figuratively, but I guess we'll never know.
Maybe these species are super tasty. And we just
it's
don't
possible.
Know. I
it's
want possible. A recipe. Give me a recipe page.
Give us a recipe book. That would be gross. Batwoman number 2 from DC Comics, written by Greg Rucka, art by Danny. This is continuing the Next Level story. And in this issue, Batwoman's father realizes that she's in a pretty bad way and goes after her, leading to a pretty bloody ending to the issue. Yeah. Of the Next Level titles, correct if I'm wrong, but I felt like we liked this, but mostly for the art. How are you feeling on issue 2?
I like this. I think this has a very, like, it's a continuation of the story, and that feels very palpably so. Like, it's definitely the characters aren't reintroducing themselves. There's not a lot of, like, remember. It's just, like, a straight continuation of what of the run from before that Rucka did. And I like that run. I like that it's different. It feels very European. The art style is so different from what had come before, but it really works because the setting has changed. And we're not really riding with Batwoman right now. She is the sort of axis of these first two issues that everyone is orbiting around, but we don't know what's happening with her. And I feel like that's intentional. So I'm excited to get inside her head.
Yeah, that's the thing that I'm missing a little bit, is I'm not quite sure why she's doing what she's doing, but also we're not supposed to know that, which makes it a little bit of a tough read from a story perspective. But man, Danny's art is just so good,
really good
in this issue as well. Just absolutely beautiful scenes, some brutal action throughout. So I'm definitely going to keep reading this. I will say this is jumping the gun a little bit, but we have our three Next Level books all came out again this week. And the two others have covers with Deathstroke and Lobo sitting with their backs to the camera. And I feel like Batwoman kind of missed the boat there. Like, she's facing the camera on the cover. So,
Wow. That's I don't know if that's what are you reading into this?
Literally nothing. Literally. Okay. It's just I looked at three covers and noticed something. So there you
go. Nice. Okay, really channeling Pete here. I do like, but this reflects the content in a great way. I think this is a very accurate cover. Something
great
we're always chasing.
Very cool cover. Venom 257 from Marvel, written by Charles Soule, art by Javier Pina. This is continuing the Death Spiral storyline, and in fact is the penultimate chapter, as Carnage has bonded with Torment and Peter Parker, a.k.a. Spider-Man, and Mary Jane, a.k.a. Venom, are hot onto his tail. Torment is going after Aunt May and Aunt Anna, with only Flash Thompson standing in the way. I think so far we've been loving the Death Spiral crossover. How are they doing in the next-to-last chapter, Justin?
Again, I'm surprised how much I'm enjoying this, because it felt a little bit random smashing all these titles together, but over the course of this series, this crossover, and the next issue, I believe, is the last, the story's just gotten tighter, and they've done so effectively here is they created this villain Torment that I was like, oh, okay, probably another symbiote. I'm sure, like, it's either slightly worse than Carnage or maybe related to Anti-Venom somehow or something like that, just because of the coloration. But in fact, Torment seems quite different and is actually a super interesting character. Yeah. Almost the opposite of what I said about Absolute Batman. This crossover has highlighted the villain and really zeroed in on them. Like, Spider-Man, Venom, barely in this. And just really there to be like, stop! When it's really about Carnage and Torment mostly, and finding out what makes Torment work and why they are doing these horrible things. And I really love the compulsory nature of it.
Well, the crazier thing to me about Torment, and I agree with you about the character completely working and being very compelling, particularly in this issue, is, as far as I'm aware, there's no who's under the mask mystery going on. And I don't feel, other than I just said it, like, I don't feel compelled to talk about that. And every other time in comics, when there's some sort of character who shows up, you don't know their real name, you don't know their backstory, you don't know that he's like Teddy Orment and he fell in a torment vortex or whatever and got his powers out of that.
Really good.
Thank you. I'm just riffing here. But none of that matters. Like, it isn't important because we know what he wants and we know what it's doing to him and we know what it's doing to these other characters. And that's the important thing, how it's pushing Peter, how it's pushing Mary Jane, and this issue, the ants and Flash Thompson. And that's great. It's really good storytelling.
I like grouping Anna Watson and Aunt May as the ants. Like, they should be a real force out there.
Yeah. Doing team up something with Ant Man.
Get a symbiote on those. Come ladies. On. Get in there. You can yes. be little ants. But I will say, I would even double down further on this. I thought we were going to get a like who's under the mask moment. Mm-hmm. And we still might, actually. Like, it feels like they're teasing it a little bit. But as I was reading this issue in particular, I was like, I don't want this to be a person. This character's too interesting. I don't want it to be an ancillary Spider family character that will then reset back to something else. Because I think Torment is a great villain to have on the table in the Spider-Man universe as well as the Marvel universe as a whole, because Torment can chase any spiral and start. This is a great villain for any hero, from the Punisher to any.
I wonder how much Charles Soule had to do with the creation, because it feels very Muse adjacent. You know? Like, it's the same. Totally different characters, but just in terms of, like, I'm a serial killer that has a very iconic look and has a very specific MO.
Yeah. A very specific compulsion to do something. They have to kill in a certain way, and if they don't kill in that way, they don't want to do it.
Yeah.
Which is the opposite of Carnage, which I think why this is so effective, and I'm like, it makes me mad at Carnage even more in this issue. Like, stop bothering
freaking everyone. Carnage.
Yeah.
All right, moving on to G.I. Joe, number 21, from Skybound and Image Comics, written by Joshua Williamson, art by Tom Riley. In this issue, some of the team is going back to get Scarlet, and we get, and I really should have seen this coming, another sort of silent interlude issue, because it's G.I. Joe 21, which is all the rage right now. Not only is Skybound running a bunch of one-shots that are silent interludes, and Feral number 21 was a silent interlude, but now there is some dialogue at the beginning and end here, but otherwise it's silent. What'd you think, Justin?
I think the best way to honor this issue is to have our own silent tribute, where we can all imagine Pete reading this and being like, "Oh, sick! Oh, yeah!" And
then I bet he doesn't like it, and I bet he doesn't like it because they talked at the beginning and the end.
Yeah, that's it's not advertised as a silent issue. I mean, I feel like for whatever, like, Storm Shadow is like, he doesn't talk, so it's like, well, no one talks. And like, that's an annoying.
Yeah.
Do you think he's like a little pushy in that way where he's like, guys, Shh, hush. I'm here. He's like a walking library.
I do think they did a good job.
I'm talking. I'm talking over here.
Hey, I'm talking here. Tom Riley did a great job with the art. I will say I'm good with the silent interlude issues after this. We don't need to do that anymore unless we make a law that every 21st issue of every comic needs to be a silent interlude.
Wow. I mean, we're right there. Wait, that may have become a law because that's what's been happening for the last couple months. I don't mind a silent issue. I think this story was a little complex. Mm-hmm. Like, I would have liked a little bit more explanation of what's happening because it's beautifully done. The fight sequences are awesome, especially like the end when the sword weapon that everyone's chasing is brought out. And like, that was awesome. Mm-hmm. But, and maybe like I'm just missing some context as not a Joe fan, but I was like, everyone's mad here. I wanted a little bit more understanding why.
Yeah. Star Trek, Starfleet Academy, Lost Contact, number one from IDW, written by Lane Morgan, art by Corelli Espuna. This is tying into the just-canceled Paramount Plus series.
Sick.
There still is another season of it coming, but a real bummer for a lot of people. It was canceled right after season one.
It's crazy. The idea of canceling before a second season comes out is absolutely insane.
They should have just shot all the actors in the knees.
Exactly. There's no reason to do it this way. What are you doing? Why are you doing it this way? It's crazy.
I don't know. This is too big of a topic to talk right now in terms of like what's going on in the world of Star Trek. But the short version is, yeah, you've got one season of Starfleet Academy that's already been shot that ostensibly is going to be on Paramount Plus at some point. You've got two more seasons of Strange New Worlds, which have already been shot, which ostensibly are going to be on Paramount Plus at some point. But at the same time, Alex Kurtzman, who's running Star Trek, his contract is up in September, and he's been running it since like pretty much since the beginning of the Discovery era back in 2017 or whatever it is. Plus Paramount has the Warner Brothers merger. They're focused on theatrical. So like Star Trek in general feels hobbled right now. So I was really hoping that I'd crack this open and be like, oh, yeah, this is cool. I'm reinvigorated for Star Trek. I'm imagining you didn't watch the show, so I'm curious to hear from you first, Justin, what you thought about this.
Well, yeah, I didn't watch the show, but I actually enjoyed this. I feel like I rarely get – and I really love Star Trek, but I fell off like a few years ago, and I'm behind on literally all of the television. And I do want to catch up on that eventually. I'll have to, like, break both my legs probably to do that. And you can put that on the DVD case if you want. but I did enjoy this because what I like about it is it feels like a horror movie. It feels like a horror TV show in a way that you don't usually get that genre done well in any Star Trek. That's something they just don't touch well, and it makes sense. A lot of people probably don't come to Star Trek for that, but this has the right vibe for it. Everything is good for that. You can feel the mistakes accumulating and the bad stuff about to happen to these people. And the art is a great reflection of that, so I enjoyed it.
I did watch all of Starfleet Academy and really did not like most of the first season. Just I didn't think it was very well done, not for any of the troll-like reasons that people posted online. But I do think it ended very strong. The last two episodes in particular were pretty great. I really enjoyed them quite a bit. So again, I was looking forward to this and looking forward to this being more in line with that. I personally found the story a little jumbled at points, though I think they ended an interesting point. But I do want to give a shout out to Corelli Espuna's art, which I thought was really nice. Like it has, yeah. I was hard pressed to find a comp for it, but it's this very flat compositions that still, they almost feel like cutouts at point, like people are popping out of, like these paper dolls popping out of the background, which I thought was pretty cool. So yeah. I liked looking at it. I like where it ends up. Very curious to check out the second issue for sure.
Nice.
Deathstroke, the Terminator number 2 from DC Comics, written by Tony Fleece, art by Carmine Di Giandomenico. Did I get that right?
Pretty good. I think that's pretty good.
Okay. I'm now scared of all names because of Tony. But in this issue,
I feel like he's playing a great prank on us, maybe.
100%. Absolutely. Yeah. In this issue, Deathstroke has been framed for the murder of Wintergreen and is on the run, all of his resources being cut off one by one. This is with slight breaks, essentially one big action scene, and I thought it was killer. Like, the way that Carmine lays out the paddles, it's all widescreen, it's all cinematic, it feels like, and I know this is the worst thing you can say about comic, but it really does feel like Deathstroke the movie while you're reading it. It just, it rocks.
It's so good. The colors and the art are so, like, it doesn't feel like any other comic. It has just, like, even on the cover here, you can see the sort of the way the light feels, like the light coming off the characters, the, like, lens flare you're getting from the lights in the background. You get that throughout the whole comic. Like, it's so good. It reminds me a little bit of, I can't remember his name, but a couple other artists who do this, like, that, where the tech pops, and I think that just is such a key into cinema. And using light in that way is difficult in comics. And I just got to shout out, like, it's a great story. I really like this. Tony Fleece, when we interviewed him a couple months back, he's so excited about this story, and he's leaning so hard into the, like, feel the gun oil action sequence of this, and it really is translating well. But then he gets us this last page that I want to name the characters here. We get Deathblow and Deadshot coming to kill Deathstroke. And I was like, you bastard. You got me. You got me with that. You're telling a pretty straight over the plate, great, just battle. And then you get just a great punchline at the end that undercuts things, jokes we made to him 2 months ago. That bastard. He wins again.
He does win again. The other thing that I want to give a shout out to this issue that I thought was pretty well done, and we'll see how it pans out in the long run, but there's always this temptation, not even a temptation, there's a story that happens in comics and movies and TV as well, where they're like, this character has lost all their resources. And it usually takes the form of, like, Batman has lost all of his resources other than this high-tech basement in the apartment building he owns and all of his Robins and all of his tech. And you're like, I don't know, man. I don't know how, like, down to the bone he is here right now. But this issue, at least, really is doing that. It's stripping away everything Deathstroke has one by one. And he's still pulling out things. Like, he's like, well, I still got a freaking helicopter now. But that makes it cooler because the way that Carmine is doing the acting, you see Deathstroke being like, oh, my God, what am I going to do here? I'm at my wit's end. So, anyway, enough good things said about this comic book. It's great. Pick it up.
I mean, they also, like, they're like, hey, no, we drained your Venmo. We
no access overpaid, to your PayPal.
We overpaid your last couple phone bills, so your backup bank account.
You know that Dunkin' Donuts rewards card that you had on your app? We actually took away 2 coffees, so you still got to get up to your 10th coffee. You'll never get there.
He's really up against it. He's out of options.
X-Men United, number 2 from Marvel, written by Eve L. Ewing, art by Tiago Pama. The idea of this book is that the X-Men, specifically Emma Frost, have created a school of the mind where everybody can meet together, and Cyclops hates it. He hates it. So he hates it so much he wants to burn it to the ground. And in this issue, that's exactly what he is doing, though Emma Frost is a couple of steps ahead of him. And then Captain America shows up and needs their help, and they go on a mission.
Yeah, this is a wild story.
I was a little surprised by this issue. I didn't dislike it.
You but really liked the first issue.
Loved the first issue. I thought this was a great setup for a classic school-based X-Men story. There were great character dynamics. We finally got all the characters together in the same place. Loved Cyclops as ostensibly the villain here. But then the second issue is like, get out of here, Cyclops, after the first 5 pages. He's like, all right, I guess I'm never coming back again. And then they move to something that has nothing to do with the school, but it instead is like, well, sometimes we got to work for Captain America to look into the Patriot program from that comic book back in the day. Yeah, and it's such a weird move for the second issue after that solid setup of the first issue.
It goes so far so fast. And even once they get the Captain America of it all, then they're still like, actually, there's some time displacement happening, and all these mutants you sort of know are split into all these different moments in American history. I was like, what is this about? And like, I like the mass of ideas. I always like just like the best comics are all about like, guess what? I thought about all of this. But this just feels a little bit too far afield, too early. Like, I want to sit in this premise a little bit. The premise is wild enough that there's a school in the mind happening here.
Yeah, like, let's go outside the mind. Stay in the mind.
Let's be in the mind. Because, like, there's so much to explore and establish here. So I would love to do that. But it also does feel like, hurry, we have to make this book interesting and different, and so it sells or something.
I guess. I don't know. I, as an X-Men fan, what I want to see is the X-Men at a school. Like, that's what I want to see. I know that's the thing that we've seen millions of times before, but it was so pleasing in that first issue. Like you're saying, I want to sit in that for a little bit. There's a reason that dynamic works. And you can find new riffs there. And like you're saying, how does that work? What does it mean that they're a school of the mind? What are they teaching there? What about these new students we met? What about the middle-level students from Exceptional X-Men? Anyway.
I know. You like to see your Exceptional gang.
I do like the Exceptional gang. And I like the stuff that goes on here with Kitty Pryde. I thought that was well done, seeing the council as they're sitting around and talking. Anyway, we'll see what happens with the book. Hopefully it veers away and then settles back in, but we'll see. Fireborn, number one from Image Comics, written by Kurt Pyers and Franklin Jonas, art by Patrick Mulholland. This is a spinoff of Lost Fantasy, focusing on a character who gains powers thanks to a dragon egg and fights a bunch of dudes because of it. Now, we haven't totally followed Lost Fantasy, I think mostly because we thought it, at least I'll speak for myself, I thought it was a beautiful-looking book that I could never quite hold on to the story with, and we were saying kind of the same thing issue after issue. But I was curious to check this out anyway, and it's funny that this seems like a much more straight-over-the-plate Radiant Black, Rogue Sun, Invincible-type character thing. Like, very specifically, very close to Rogue Sun. But I still enjoyed it, and I thought the art was great. There's some really good layout choices in here in particular.
Even beyond those Radiant Black and Rogue Sun, which I definitely get that reference. I mean, it even looks a bit like Rogue Sun. I was getting so many of, like, updated Image, early Image vibes here.
Yes, absolutely.
This feels so like a modern, even the look of the character is like modern Shadowhawk. Even to the point where a lot of, there are so many references in here that I'm like, Golden Bachelor? Why are you saying that? And it feels, that's what those first Image books were doing back then. It felt like saying like, look, we're fresher than any other comics you're reading out there. And like, I get that. I don't need you to prove that to me. I think the story will prove that. So referencing the Golden Bachelor and the other, like, there's some food references in here that I'm like, these are very current, but that's not what I come to comics for. You don't need to prove your topicality. Like, the story will prove relevant based on its, what it's telling. And I like some of the stuff that happens here. It's just a little confusing at points about who maybe is who is a younger version of another character, perhaps, and what the everyone's sitting around is. And then it ties into the larger universe very specifically at the end. And I was like, oh, well, that's going to be a whole thing, too.
Yeah. Again, I really like the art here. There's a double page splash where two characters run into each other that I thought was very cool and well laid out. If you turned away from Lost Fantasy, I think it's worth checking this out anyway, because there are some fun visuals in here.
Definite fresh start from in the Lost Fantasy world.
Definitely. And here's a fresh ending from Night City, number 3 from Dark Horse Comics, written by Matt Kent, art by David Lapham. This is, in the most basic version, been about a Superman-type character who has trouble falling asleep, but when he does fall asleep, he ends up in another world where he's essentially the Clark Kent, the guy with no powers, and his Lex Luthor finds out about this and starts really messing things up, leading to a big climactic confrontation at the end. as usual with these three-issue stories from Bad Kid, I just thought this was great. Like, it's so focused, so creative, goes in some wild directions. I thought the ending was really big and interesting here, and just some beautiful art from David Lapham.
It feels like just a great, trippy 70s comic. Like, there's so much, like, Silver Age juice behind this, reminding me of, like, Miracle Man and that sort of type of comic storytelling where it's one idea that we're just going to, like, jump around mentally around these, like, known areas and find, like, a cool, haunting story in that same world. And the art reflects that perfectly. It's not super trippy. It's a little, it feels a little bit just out of time, a little like Silver Age-y. Like, they really enjoyed this.
Well, and I love all these titles that Matt Kent is essentially, I don't know if this is how he's starting his process, but essentially like, hey, what if Superman and Clark Kent were two guys? What would that be like? And then kind of going from there. Or there was the title that I'm completely blanking on that was basically a Legion of Superheroes book in all but name, where he's just riffing off of these things, then taking them 2 degrees further. But it's more than that. It isn't just him doing his ripoff. It's figuring out, okay, then what is the emotional or thematic thing I want to deal with over the course of 3 issues? It's just, it's great.
It feels like his version of Jeff Lemire, Black Hammer. Like,
100%,
and not taken all at once the way Black Hammer was, and just being like a little bit more spare with it, being like, oh, I'm gonna pull this out of the comic book consciousness and tell my version of it, and then this over here, and like that's just a great. And when we talked to Matt at New York Comic Con, and he was sort of like, I'm making big moves, and it feels like that's what he's doing. He's establishing this just spot in the universe that he occupies, and it's such a smart place to be.
End of Life, number 3 for DC Vertigo, written by Kyle Starks, art by Steve Pugh. We are following an assassin who has run out of town to stay with his dying father because there's a group called the Menagerie that is after him and wants to kill him. In this issue, I believe DC was referring to as the character find of the century, Big Cock, shows up to kill him, and this is a guy with an enormous chicken head who only says big cock, and they fight. And that's the short version of it. Yes, Justin?
No, there's more. There's a little bit more to it, but that's definitely the part that you'll remember. That's definitely the old takeaway, is the back third or so is just a great big cock. It's a great big cock fight.
Yeah.
That happens here, which just, is really
this
good.
This is a very funny, fun book with some ridiculous action and great characters. It's just Kyle Starks and Steve Pugh are two of the best comedy people working in comics right now, and that's coming to bear in this book. This is one of my favorite Vertigo books that's coming out right now, maybe my favorite one. It's just really good, every single issue.
It's pure fun. It's pure, like, gotcha throughout. Like, and Vertigo has always had that sort of strain, but it's not the part that fits the brand as much. Mm-hmm. It's always been on the fringe of Vertigo, but it's important, and I'm glad this book is there in the line. It's important to have it there.
And I just want to give a shout-out to one bit. I don't know how many more times he's going to do it, but our main character is actually a very good assassin, which I think is a really good choice. Normally you'd be like, oop, he's a hapless fool, and isn't that funny? But no, he's actually very good at it. The previous issue, he killed a bunch of dudes and just left them in the woods. And this issue, one of the characters dies in the same spot in the woods. And if they're just going to keep killing people and leaving them in the same spot in the woods, that's very funny. I'm really looking forward to it. We'll see. Alias Red Band, number 2 from Marvel, written by Sam Humphries, art by Geraldo Borges. In this issue, Jessica Jones and Typhoid Mary are teaming up to solve a mystery. That goes about as well as you would expect.
I think this is really working. It's so good. Like, it's taking, and I feel like, I don't know how it actually works behind the scenes, but it feels like when a story, when a character like, or a book like Alias comes up, everyone knows this book was big and was about pushing the boundaries and being like a different type of storytelling. And man, does the creative team live up to that idea, both artistically with like really changing up the angles and the look for the different pages, doing some really tight stuff, some wider stuff. But, like, comedically, this issue was excellent. There's, like, a running... the villain here is really interesting. The Postcard Man? Is that his name?
Yeah.
And he, like... He uses a typewriter, and Typhoid Mary throughout the issue is, like, coming up with names for typewriter fandom. And it's very funny. It really it crushes. And I like the stakes that Jessica's dealing with, where she's like, well, I'm about to get divorced because of this. Typhoid Mary being the wild card and sort of, like, crazy cop to her straight cop is just great.
Last issue, I said that it felt like, and this wasn't meant dismissively, that Sam Humphries was doing his best Brian Michael Bendis impression. This issue feels like he started to jazz riff in another direction, because there's things that, like you're saying, there's really great pages that feel like they're a deconstruction of the classic Bendis, here's a two-page splash where everybody's talking over each other thing, but it's laid out in a very different way and plays out in a different way. So you get that sense there, but it's starting to move further and further away from that place that it started, where Alias started. So yeah, I agree. This is very cool. Yeah. Ice Cream Man, number 45 from Image Comics, written by W. Maxwell Prince, art by Martine Morazzo. This is another riff on Hitchcock stuff here, as we get a very specific riff on Rear Window in particular, a guy who is looking across the street in an apartment where he thinks he sees a murder, but then it ends up going in some absolutely awful Ice Cream Man directions. This title has been away for a really long time. How'd you feel about having it back?
Needed it. Missed it. Loved it. Love reading this. This book just operates differently. It burrows into your eyes and then brain in a different way than all these other, every other book we're talking about here in the stack and all other comics. Like, just something about this from the very first issue, like, there's a bugs under the skin vibe to this every issue. And this one nails it again and turns the camera on us and is like, I'm watching you.
Yeah.
Which is cool.
Yes, it is interesting to see W. Maxwell Prince go from the really personal place that he's been in for the past couple of issues of this to go back to doing, like, classic Ice Cream Man type things. But like you said, it's still riffing on our relationship with comic books and reading comic books. The art is great. The writing is great. It's beautiful to look at. So, yes, always read Ice Cream Man.
Yes.
Smile for the Camera, number 2 from IDW, written by Hannah Rose May, art by Mariana Puglia. This is a riff, spin-off, of the Smile horror series, the film series, and here we're focusing on a bunch of fashion models who travel around the world and have caught the Smile virus, which is killing them off one by one. I think you were not here when we talked about the first issue, if I remember, Justin. So I don't know about your relationship with the Smile film series, but what did you think about this issue?
I like this. Like, it reminds me of some of the sort of unique concept killer books we've read lately, like I Was a Fashion School Serial Killer. Mm-hmm. It has that vibe of just being like introducing us to a world. The Smile, you don't have to have watched the Smile movies to know what's happening. I'm sure it helps, but like it, you get it, and it's paced like a horror movie, but you still get to know the characters, and it really does a good job of just keeping us in the fashion world really well.
The funny thing is, knowing about the Smile series doesn't necessarily hurt the comic book, but the problem with the series is the rules are weird and kind of non-specific. Like, this was a big problem with the first movie, is they sort of went all over the place. The second movie is excellent, much more focused, but still there's something about, like, how this Smile virus, this Smile contagion works that doesn't really make sense when you think about it too much. That was like top of mind while I was reading this issue, being like, oh, right, that doesn't make a lot of sense. But that's not the fault of the comic book, because I do think, like you're saying, they do a good job of building the tension here. It feels very intimate and interior with the fashion world. And there's a really nice setup of having this group of fashion models that are getting offed one by one. So good stuff.
Yeah, and I've only seen the first Smile and didn't really, I wasn't like putting that in top of mind when I was reading this, so I wasn't as concerned about the rules. It played like a mystery to me of them trying to figure it out, not like they have to know the rules to survive.
Yeah. Lobo, number two from DC Comics, written by Scotty Young, art by Jorge Corona. In this issue, Lobo is working for a multi-universal corporation that is forcing him to be part of their reality show. In the issue, he is forced, I guess, to fight Aquaman, among other people, leading to a status quo change by the end of the issue. We talked to Scotty a couple of weeks back. He talked about a bunch of stuff about this book, but one of the things that I thought was very interesting knowing this versus issue one going into issue two is him talking about how he's playing very loose with his writing process so that he can respond more, be more improvisational as he goes. And knowing that, I think that really plays out in how this issue plays out. I just repeated myself, but you know what I mean. Sorry, Justin, go ahead.
Yes, I agree. It feels loose. The story feels loose in a good way that matches Lobo. It's strange to have in a comic where the form can flex, but it's rarely flexed in this way where it feels like we don't know what's going to happen. Any new page is a new thing. Feels like comic book, you're expecting the form to be it's a very functional form. How the panels are laid out are specific to the storytelling. This feels like the story's driving the paneling in an interesting way, and the character's vibe and attitude, Lobo's, like, the way he is a chaos element, is making the story work more chaotically. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, that's definitely not a criticism. I think it's actually making this the best version of a Lobo book you could imagine. And especially when it comes in sharp relief when he encounters Aquaman or Emperor Aquaman, where it's like, uh-oh, that's a very regular thing for him to encounter. But his chaos rolls over him. It's such a power issue for Lobo.
Yeah. Jorge Corona's art, once again, is the real standout to me here. It's just absolutely perfect for this book. And Scotty even talked about how he was leading into what Jorge was doing and just sort of letting him go hog wild. The one thing I want to bring up that, again, was top of mind because of the interview, Scotty never came out and said this, but he very strongly intimated that the company that Lobo works for originally was Warner Brothers. Like, he literally had it as Warner Brothers or potentially DC Comics in the script. And I just kept thinking about, because there are jokes about like mergers and being sold in this very issue, that, man, it is such a bummer that he didn't just get to do that, because like the driving force behind this book is Looney Tunes, right? And they used to do that in Looney Tunes. They used to talk about Warner Brothers all the time and break the fourth wall. And it's a bummer that in this day and age you can't do something like that because the corporation gets upset. But the sense is there regardless. Tigress Island, number two from Image Comics, written by Patrick Kindlin, art by EPHK. This is about a bunch of ladies from different backgrounds who have been taken into slavery by a mysterious island owner. We don't get to meet him or her necessarily this issue, but they are dealing with their new reality that they are imprisoned on an island and they just want to get off. I think we like the art of the first issue, but of the three of us, we're mixed on the story. How'd you feel about issue two?
I don't know how I feel about this. I like the moves of the story, but like, I guess I don't know what the point is quite yet.
Right.
Is that, how do you feel? Is that,
no, am I reading I feel that the wrong? Same way. I mean, I think one of the things that I'm having a problem with is the same thing as the first issue, is there are too many characters, and frankly, it's a little hard to tell them apart. And then beyond that, they also all get new haircuts this issue, or most of them get new haircuts. And then there's a little too much of equal time spent on all of them versus, I think this would really benefit, you're going to hate me for me to say this, but from like a Lost type structure where we're focusing on one character per issue and then meeting the other characters around them. So we can really dial in, or like Nice House on the Lake does that, if you want to use a comic book example, where it really dials in on one person so we can learn a little bit more about that person. Here, they keep going in a round and being like, I am this person and I did that thing, but I can't really keep track of who they are or what they're doing or why they're doing it, or like you're saying, why they're there, other than sexy ladies on an island in prison is a bunch of tropes.
Right. Yeah. I agree with you. And just, I get that there's a mystery here that the characters don't know what's happening to them, but there's so much attitude and juice by the sort of story engine of what's happening around them that I'm like, give me a little direction on that so I can figure out how to feel about it. Because it feels like I'm with them, but like, look, this cover is telling a different story than the issue is internally. Like, it just feels like I want to set my sights on something. The window is too wide.
New Titans 34 from DC Comics, written by Tate Bromble, art by Sammy Basri. Last issue, Nightwing discovered that he was trapped in some sort of repetitive nightmare that was keeping him with the Titans team, all fueled by coffee. And the cliffhanger of the last issue is that the new Titans showed up. This issue, we find out a lot more about what is going on as the teams try to work together to escape. I thought the first issue was fantastic. How did you feel about the second issue, Justin?
Ooh, what a twist. I like this, really focused on Cyborg here. Mm-hmm. A character that is not one of my faves, I would say, but I like the way he's used in this. He's almost like it feels very Tony Stark-y here, mm-hmm. where he's like the man who has the answers, trying to just get to the. There's a reveal at the end that I think he's being the information controller here throughout, and we're along for his ride.
This book does what I was talking about with the last book, I think, where the first issue focused on Nightwing. Like you're saying, the second issue focuses, oh my gosh, who's narrating it? It's Tara who's narrating it, which I thought was a really smart choice. So it is focusing on one character when you have this big white ensemble that's playing around. There is the mystery element. I love that this is going in very surprising different directions, you know, not to keep calling out other comic books, but Jed MacKay has this new run over in Marvel on Moon Knight, where Moon Knight woke up in a mind prison of the first issue, and I was surprised that he had broken out of it by the end of the first issue, but they really made it work at the second issue. This is a similar thing, where they had the mind prison, but they found a way to be like, okay, you know they're in a mind prison, let's move past that, but find a new iteration of that that is interesting and adds new details. And this is a cool mix of a team. I also love that we're getting, like, we know the Titans characters and the new Titans. We also know them for the most part, but they're very much on the outside. So we're like, huh? Who are you? How'd you get together? What's going on here? So it's very off-kilter at the same time.
Well, it's like the flip of the classic, like, new team book, where it's 100%. Like everyone walks through and is like, hi, I'm blank, and I'm going to be the big tough one or whatever. And this is sort of like, catch up. The teams are here. In fact, there's two teams. Guess who's on the real team? You won't know until we actually show you.
Yeah, and there's also some great complications that happen here. Like, I love the romantic complication that Nightwing and Starfire hooked up while they're in this mind prison, and now they're going to have to deal with that with Barbara. That seems bad, but good dramatically.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm the biggest Dick Barbara guy out here, but I do like Dick and Starfire, too. Mm, so here we are.
All right. I'm digging this title. Time. Excited to see where it goes next. Next up, Narco, number 2 from Image Comics, written by Doug Wagner, art by Daniel Hilliard. This is about a dude who has narcolepsy, fell asleep, woke up next to the dead body of his crush neighbor, and he is initially framed for it, but it actually ends up okay, and then he joins the investigation.
Yeah, there's a lot of fast turnaround in this, because the way this story is told, the coyness of it, ironically reminds me of a book, the book Sleep, which is about sleeping too much. And this is about falling asleep also too much.
I actually thought there would be more falling asleep, because he barely falls asleep this issue. So I don't know exactly what's going on there. There's a lot of weirdness happening. This team always puts weirdness and jokes and arch humor into their books. So I will definitely check out a third issue for sure. But it felt like they could be playing with the narcolepsy of it all, other than right at the beginning, he wakes up next to the body, and then he passes out, wakes up at the police station, and then he's pretty much fine for the rest of the issue.
Well, it's only when then the good things happen, so he's not stressed, so he doesn't have to fall asleep.
Yes, I don't know. That's the concept. Play with the concept.
Yeah, well, I'm sure we're going to get back to it, but the way that the one cop is like, nah, he's cool now. It's like,
what?
Like, oh, cool. Man, this cop really turned around. You don't really see that as much in law enforcement.
Not as much, and I wish we did, honestly.
Yeah. Let's bring this accused criminal out on the case with us.
It's called Let's Do a Silence of the Lambs. Superman Unlimited, number 12 from DC Comics, written by Dan Slott, art by Lucas Meyer. Young John Kent is back in the mix, thanks to some multiversal machinations in the last issue. And our older John Kent is now pretending to be Tomorrow Man. This issue, he takes little John over to see his mom while hiding out himself and trying not to ruin what's going on there for some reason that I'm not quite sure about. But
yeah.
Anyway, lots of machinations going on with there. And at the same time, everybody is a little suspicious of little John being back. Justin, what'd you think?
Yeah, I mean, the Dan Slott is like has his loves, and it feels like he's starting with his loves and then writing toward them. Like having young John Kent come back and it not really needing to make sense right away. He's like, I'll figure it out. And like all the other characters, like, this is weird. Like, I feel like the story is reflecting maybe is a little bit meta to me of it being like, this is a weird choice, but there's a point to it that I think Dan's getting to. He also loves Bibbo, so Bibbo's there.
Yes. He did tell us all about that two-page splash of Bibbo meeting Beppo, and it is pretty funny. I really like the emotion in this issue. There is a page where John comes back and Damian is there, and that really got me.
These characters are important. They were so good. There was something. Super Sons is almost a lost book, I feel like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe this is going to turn out to be like a fourth dimensional imp or a fifth dimensional imp or something like that, which would be a real bummer. There is a part of me that I don't know what you do with the older John Kent at this point. There's already too many super characters, but having the younger John back would be great. I really think aging him up was one of the bigger mistakes in comics, even if we got some good John Kent stories after that. So,
wow. Oh, well. Strong take.
No, I don't know. It was great. The dynamic with him and Damian was great. It was really good, and it felt really unique.
Having them figuring out how to be superheroes together and them coming at everything from opposite sides almost is very smart. And honestly, I wish they played that dynamic a little bit more, even with the aged up John Kent, because he is the same person. So could easily do that.
Radiant Black, number 41 from Image Comics, written by Kyle Higgins and Joe Clark, art by Paulo Daniel Santos and Marcelo Costa. In this issue, Shift and Radiant Black are going on a mission together while a lot of other things are going on, and they find out a secret about the new mysterious villain that has shown up in town. What'd you think, Justin?
This is cool. I mean, this story has really, it's really like just paced itself to, we're telling you a gigantic story. Like, how big is this story? From the giant, like, cataclysm from, when was that, like, 12 issues ago? Was that, like, a year ago-ish?
I don't think it was that long, but it definitely was a couple of months ago, for sure.
Yeah. It's really started, it's just like, no, we're moving through this. There's a lot of, like, things we're commenting on from, like, bureaucracy, how government, media, and all of that works. And this issue gets us to a place of revelation in the back half, which I really liked. I liked the sort of science-y explanation that, again, took the time to tell us a, like, four-page version of something that could have been like, yeah, watch out, he's got to plug this thing into him. Hurry! Instead, they are really... And I like that's the confidence of the storytelling in this book that's been on display for so long is really paying dividends, I feel like, now.
The only note that I would give this book is, and I'm going to peek out here for a moment, is I really wish it picked up on the cliffhangers, because for the past couple of issues in particular, when I start an issue of Radiant Black, I'm like, did I miss an issue? What's going on here? Because they end in these big places, but then they don't pick up on that in the next issue. Or if they do, it's somewhere in the middle of the issue. So I don't know. That keeps throwing me. Maybe that's a reader problem but not a book problem. I'm not sure.
Well, it's a little bit of like a different twist on like the way Invincible did it. Mm-hmm. Invincible would often pick up on the cliffhangers, but they would just set up a ton of stuff to pay off later. And I think doing it this way is like cliffhanger, wait for that. You're not getting it yet, but there's another cliffhanger coming that you can also wait for.
Yep. Wonder Woman, number 32 from DC Comics, written by Tom King, art by Daniel Sempere. This is continuing the Wonder War storyline that's taking place in the future, as Wonder Woman and Trinity have teamed up to try to take down the matriarch who has taken over the entire world. Meanwhile, she is having an interview in the Oval Office, which is also now part of the White House. Princess Castle is, I guess, the best way of describing what's going on
there. She Disneyfied the White House.
100%. And also we get to see the Flash beaten to death, among other horrible things that happen, leading to a big surprising cliffhanger that happens here. Justin, what'd you think?
I mean, Tom King with this book is doing like the most subtle satire that I've seen in a while. Like the Disneyfication of the White House is so Trump fucking up the White House. But in a way that is like so removed, like you can't make that connection directly. So I feel like that's, you know, he's being the same with Mouse Man, was just like a couple steps removed logically from being a comment on like Trumpian fascism. But I still think it was that very directly.
The whole interview was that. All of the language that the matriarch is using, all of the deferring and non-answers of questions is something directly from our world today and how the White House is treating things. So 100%. And at the same time, you have this killer action that's going on with Wonder Woman and Trinity, who are just the most confident characters I've ever seen in my life as they march their way in. I'll also give a shout out to Daniel Sempere. I mean, we've said this every single issue, but the art is off the hook. There is a panel here of Superman, who has been imprisoned, realizing that Wonder Woman and Trinity are coming, where it's just a close-up of him smiling that is so good.
Yeah.
So good. And that's the least of it. Like, everything in this is great.
And we talked about this as like sort of a sneaky full like line crossover, but just done in this title.
Yeah.
And it plays this story plays so big because of all of the big character deaths that are happening and all the things that the matriarch has done just being played out in front of us.
Yeah, it's great stuff. And last but not least, Red Coat number 17 from Ghost Machine and Image Comics, written by Jeff Johns, art by Brian Hitch. Red Coat's arch enemy, Benedict Arnold, is back. But now they're being forced to work together with a older, but not totally older, Albert Einstein, who is back in the mix as well, leading to some big revelations potentially in the next issue. Justin, this is one of your favorite books month after month. Period.
The Red Coats are coming, and they're here, and I'm here for them. Of all the books in Jeff Johns' line here, this one just really hits with me. I don't know. It's hard for me to say exactly why. I think the Simon Pierre as a character just really is just so direct. He's so right there on the page. Feels so cleanly written. I like the moves that happen here. With his arch nemesis coming back, Albert Einstein is just an enduring the Robin to his Batman in such a funny way. But the stakes are still high. This is about immortality. It's about like founding fathers and what they could have meant and could have been thinking and different places for them, the socioeconomic background that was happening back then and how it reflects on these characters in the modern world. It's just like, there's a lot of small things on display here, but the main characters are the real part that I really enjoy.
Yeah, it's also a good mythology that I'm really enjoying, and yeah. Simon Pure has been showing up in some of the other Ghost Machine books as well, which has been very fun. So, like you said, it's just really solid month after month. And folks, that is it for the stack. If you'd like to support this podcast and all the podcasts we do, patreon.com/comicbookclub. Also, we do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. to YouTube. Come hang out. We would love to chat with you about comic books. Apple, Spotify, Android, or the app of your choice to subscribe, listen, and follow the show. Comicbookclublive.com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.
And I'm just going to be the Jim Gordon to your Batman here for a hot second, okay? Catch me!
They fail at that special guest speak. So grab your ring.